No, they're further along. They're not.
Let's call the Labor and Commerce Committee together. It's the 4th of March, 1991, 3:39 p.m. Present are Senators Pierce Collins and Senator Elias, and Senator Petula will be joining us as soon as he's finished in the governor's office. We have before us today Senate Bill 70, Senate Bill 73, 74, and 76, and Senate Bill 83 up for another hearing. Senate Bill 70 we will take up first. That's municipal taxation of certain property of governmental entities. And it is a bill that I introduced. You have, in, by the way, we are on teleconference. You have in your file information about Senate Bill 70 that has come out of Community and Regional Affairs Committee. It is a bill that we had introduced last year at the request of the Municipal League, and it died the last day in House rules, and so we reintroduced it this year. It's pretty straightforward. It would allow taxation of real property acquired by state and federal agencies through foreclosure or deed in lieu of foreclosure retained for investment purposes. It was requested, as I said, by the Municipal League because we have millions of dollars of assessed value that are being removed from the assessment rolls in our state by governmental agencies. And these are agencies that have foreclosed on property in which they had a security interest. Some of the agencies, like ADA and PERS and TERS, have been exempted. Others, like Alaska Housing, do pay local property taxes. This would bring all of the entities, all of the state and federal entities under the same law, and everybody would pay property taxes when they foreclosed on properties. It's supported by both the Municipality of Anchorage, the Alaska Association of Assessing Officers, and, as I said, the Municipal League. We have both Scott Burgess and Mike Worley, the State Assessor, with us today to testify. Do either of you have any questions before we ask them to come forward? Okay. If not, Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Scott. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Scott Burgess with the Alaska Municipal League. You have a copy of our position paper, and we support the piece of legislation. We appreciate your introduction of it. It does address the issues that we believe add some fiscal stability among municipalities on areas where basically public agencies are holding certain properties either in competition with the private sector, which don't benefit from the tax exemption, and where in fact municipalities providing services to those investments, holding up the value, protecting the value, if not enhancing the value of those properties for which there is no reimbursement through the tax system. So unless there are specific questions, appreciate the support. Look forward to its passage.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Burgess? Thank you, Scott. Mike Worley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Worley. I'm with Community and Regional Affairs, and I'm the State Assessor. The department has submitted a position paper on Senate Bill 70. I won't belabor the points made in that position paper. If there are questions about the program effects, however, I'd be happy to address those. Suffice to say, the department does support the passage of the bill in its entirety, the state, the federal, and local taxability of municipally and state and federally owned properties. If there are no questions, or if there are any questions, I'd be glad to respond to those.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for Mr. Worley? Thanks. You might note in your file you have fiscal notes from Department of Commerce, ADA, Department of Commerce Investments, Department of Revenue, Department of Community and Regional Affairs, and also position papers from Commerce and from the Municipal League itself. Thank you, but everything in order. Any discussion on Senate Bill 780? By the way, we had this noticed a couple of weeks back when we pulled the bill. There was some question about whether or not Department of Natural Resources lease state lands that have been leased, if they came back to the state, whether or not they would fall under this bill, which was not something that we had intended. And our attorneys and the Department of Law tell us that that would not be the case. We don't have a problem with those sorts of properties. So, any discussion? Okay, I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move for the substitute for Senate Bill 70 CIA.
Okay, there's a motion to move Senate Bill 70. Any opposition? Okay. Senate Bill 70 is moved with individual recommendations. On now to health bills. We have Senate Bills 73, 74, and 76. The prime sponsor being Senator Petula, up for first hearings today. Kathy, feel free to join us if you would. And Senator Duncan, if you'd like to join us at the table, we are welcome to do so. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kathy Hathaway. I work for Senator Petula. If it's all right with the committee, could I ask if Mike Ford, the drafting attorney, could
sure.
join me?
Yeah, that's fine. And feel free to handle these however you'd like in terms of going through our three of them.
Thank you. Basically, Senator Petula has been working on health insurance bills for many years, at least for 6 years. Senate Bill 73 and 74 are kind of a two-tiered approach to try and deal with the problem, which I understand the committee is very familiar with, and testimony on Senator Duncan's bill. Senate Bill 73 would offer a minimal sort of health insurance coverage, which would be available to individuals and small businesses who have been without health insurance for the previous year. Senator Petula would envision this, if the bill passed, as being a pilot project in a small community to get some results, find out what benefit plan people want, what sort of financial results would happen. That's basically Senate Bill 73 in a nutshell. The details of Senate Bill 73 are based in large part on experiences in other states by the Robert Woods Johnson's Foundation. They've conducted a number of projects through grant processes in other states. In constructing Senate Bill 73, we've relied to a great extent on what they have been doing in other states. There are as I said, two aspects of the bill that would be available to individuals as well as small businesses. We've received some information that there are more than 6,000 small businesses in the state who do not offer their employees health insurance. Starting on page 4, line 24 of the bill, are the details of what the employer sort of plan would be. It would be offered to businesses with fewer than 15 employees. The employer would be required to pay 50% of the premium costs, and at least 75% of the employees must enroll. The bill would set in place a sliding scale of premium payments for low-income individuals. That's in place, page 5, line 27. What Senator Petula would forecast would cover the people between Medicare and 200% of the poverty level. There would also be a subsidy for employers with net business income of less than $20,000. That's on page 6, lines 18 through 23. The bill has two main cost containment aspects. The first is the plan itself, emphasizing preventative in low cost for preventative care, high cost for in-hospital care. In addition, page 4, line 10, the authority is encouraged to seek hospital discounts. It is Senator Kutula's belief that, certainly for the pilot project, that that would be something that would not be impossible at all. He's gotten information that, for example, the Champus plan that's offered to the military personnel in Alaska pays Providence 50% of their bills. Senate Bill, if I might just go right to Senate Bill 74. Thank you. Senate Bill 74 is another aspect of the same problem. If 73 is aimed at low-risk individuals, 74 is aimed at high-risk individuals. This has been the approach that has been taken in many other states, trying to control the problem. It's, as I said, two-tiered. Senate Bill 74 is based on model legislation, which is in place in 24 states. It's been a growing trend. 18 of those states have put the legislation in place since 1985. Senate Bill 74 is a high-risk health insurance pool that would be made up of all the health insurers in the state. The members would be assessed the amount by which claims exceed premium payments in proportion to their share of the Alaska health insurance market. We have some information, which unfortunately I didn't bring, which was put out by an Indiana actuary who concluded that in the typical mature pools in other states, there's been a loss ratio of an average loss ratio of 139%. Currently, the bill has 125% as a maximum, 125% of the average health insurance premium as the amount that can be charged under this high-risk pool. Senator Kutula is proposing an amendment to raise that to 140%. That would be in line with what this Indiana actuary has forecast as what should be the range, loss ratio range, that the insurers would encounter. It also is in line with the Department of Commerce's position paper, their recommendation. The benefits under the plan are page 5, lines 25 through 31. As far as deductibles, it would have deductibles of 200, 500, or 1,000 per person. Maximum copayment of 20% for all health care other than mental, 50% for mental. Stop loss of $2,000, which would mean the maximum that that a patient would have to pay in 1 year would be $2,000, again, except for mental health treatment. For Senate Bill 74, residency, page 13, line 28, is defined as 6 months. The spreadsheet that I believe your committee staff has handed out to you tries to lay it out in a understandable format as to how Senator Kutula would envision the two plans working. Using the top one is Senate Bill 74. It's we're using what has been the what's happened in Montana, which has a fairly similar population to Alaska. Montana's plan has been in operation 3 years. They right now have 190 participants, and the projected premium schedule is the premium that is charged in Montana, and we've just added 35%. Senate Bill 73, as said, it's largely it's compared to the SCOPE plan, which is offered in Denver, which also encourages preventative care, discourages in-hospital care. We're forecasting what isn't on the spreadsheet. We're forecasting that in this pilot community there would be 660 uninsured, of which at a high estimate 500 would be participating in the plan. And again, we're projecting a 20% discount for the, it would presumably have one community hospital and maybe a few doctors. The pilot would have to go in place in a community that would agree to that discount. Or that's what we would be projecting. If, Madam Chair, if you had any questions on these two bills, we could answer them, or I could just move to 76.
Any questions by any committee members? Senator Collins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have some questions. In looking at the cutoff number for employers, mm-hmm. you use the number of, excuse me. In looking at the employer size that you identified, which is 15 employees or less, why did you use that number? My understanding is that the cutoff really occurs at about 25 employees for small employers. What was your rationale for using the 15?
Senator Collins, that came from one of the plans, I believe it's Florida's. There's Senator Couture is in no way married to that. That was, we just copied somebody else and that's what they had.
So you would consider an amendment to increase that to 25?
Certainly.
I have another question.
Go ahead.
Okay, this other question that I need to have answered is, you indicate that employers would have a 50% share of the premium cost. How does that 50% share compare with what currently exists? What do employers generally share? What percentage of the cost do employers generally share?
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that. I do not think there's anything mandated in statute. It would be what the practice is and what, I suppose, what the employee market demands, the labor market would demand, would be a factor in deciding that.
Then I have one more. In your handout here, or in your statement, you indicated that the Senate Bill 74 is similar to Montana's bill. There are some restrictions in the Montana's bill, and you're using the Montana bill to kind of project some state costs. Yet you indicated that there were some restrictions in the Montana bill that were not included in your bill. What are those restrictions, and what was your rationale for not including them?
Montana's, Madam Chairman, Montana's bill, for one thing, has a $1,000 deductible, and we're projecting a $200, $500, and $1,000 deductible. That, I'd have to apologize if this is confusing, but we used Montana basically because of the population. The plan, the $200, $500, and $1,000 plan is in place in many other states other than Montana. Unfortunately, those states don't really have a lot in common with Alaska, so just to give some sort of idea of what might happen, that's why we use Montana.
I just want to, I was just interested in Senator Collins' question, Madam Chair, and I just wanted to be sure I understood. When she asked what percentage are employers paying now, I think the answer really should have been zero, because as I look at what you're trying to address is people who don't necessarily carry insurance for their employees. So if you're setting up a plan for people who don't carry insurance for their employees and mandating they pay 50%, then they're paying 50% more than they're paying now. Is that not correct?
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct.
Because you're telling small employers mm-hmm. that they will carry insurance.
I guess I was interpreting yeah. your question as meaning people who presently offer insurance. I don't know.
Right, and I don't know the answer to that yeah. either, because some employers may mm-hmm. pay the whole bit, some may pay a certain percentage, but as I understood, this was for small employers with 15 or less, if those are people who aren't presently carrying, so anything they're mandated to carry would be an increase over what they have now. Not to cause difficulty, just...
I understand, but my question was, how does that 50% compare to what the standard is for those people who are currently covering their employees? I would say if that percentage is a lot less, or it might make a difference. I mean,
Any other questions?
My point is that 50%, some employers still may not be able to afford it, and if you're going to mandate it, that's going to put them in a terrible bind. And it would seem to me that whatever percentage, you're going to mandate it, and you're going to mandate a particular participation by the employer, you have to make sure that that's still going to be within reason for the employer. Otherwise, you'll have employers going out of business and there'll be employees with no jobs.
Madam Chairman, that's a good point. And that is also a reason why Senator Couture thinks that the pilot project is a very good idea. We can test it, see what's going to happen, and then fine-tune it after the results are in.
You know how many of them are? Yeah, that's the way you know.
Other questions? I'm going to go on to 76.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senate Bill 76 is has a twofold purpose. First of all, to prohibit duplicative Medigap policies, that insurance agencies from issuing duplicative policies. Senator Kutula has gotten information, which he's provided to the committee, that there is a, has been in the past, a significant problem nationwide with abuse of duplicative policies. The second purpose would be that it would set in place NAIC Medigap standards. NAIC is the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. It's my understanding that that what is in the bill is currently in regulation. It's Senator Kutula's position that this is, as a matter of public policy, it makes for things of this magnitude, this substantive magnitude, that it makes a lot of sense to have it in statute rather than regulation. Thank you.
Any questions for Kathy about 76? Thank you very much. There are no questions. We'll go on to the people who have signed up to testify. Don Cook from the Division of Insurance has signed up to testify on all three, so. And Dave Walsh, the division director, has said that he'd be happy to answer questions, I assume in concert with you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Don Cope. I'm chief of the market surveillance section with the Division of Insurance. Do you want me to take each of the three bills? And
yes, please.
Go for it. I believe you already have our position paper. And effectively, that position paper lists a number of concerns that we feel need to be addressed before we can arrive at a final position. In the case of 73, we have, in effect, not taken a position because we feel we don't have enough information and we feel that there are conditions that need to be repaired before we do. The first of these is similar to testimony we offered on Senate Bill 73, and that is we believe in the case of Senate Bill 73, the Division of Insurance should not be the agency that is involved in that purchase. It tends to conflict with our regulatory role, our role as a regulator. If we regulate purchasers, people who provide insurance, the agents who provide insurance, and for the Division of Insurance to also be in that same position would be regulating others who do the same thing, just seems inappropriate. Not at all certain where that should be placed in this case, but we believe firmly that the Division of Insurance should not be the agency with that regulatory oversight in that in this bill. We had some concern with the provision 2155050 sub 11. It requires that the Health Insurance Authority maintain a prudent level of reserve funds to protect the solvency of the Health Insurance Fund. Those funds are basically a separate account in the general fund. And the language that currently is in there appears to cross fiscal years, which would require reappropriation. So we're not certain that language is appropriate. We don't have recommended language for it. I think there's something there that needs to be looked at. We believe that the composition of the Commission on Health Insurance Reform, which is a part of the bill, ought to include a representative from the insurance industry. Currently, it provides for a hospital or medical service corporation. There's only one of those. That's Blue Cross out of Washington. It calls for a representative of the Department of Law, a representative from healthcare consumer groups. I'm not aware of any in the state at present. There may be some. A representative of a health maintenance organization. We're also not aware of any that have formed in Alaska. And a chairman, or chairperson. Since health insurers write the major portion of coverage, of those kinds of coverages, we think that they should be included in the makeup of that commission. Finally, we have a some difficulty with the definition of health insurance. In Alaska, the definition, the term health insurance is not used in the insurance code. It's the term of art, if you will, in Alaska and primarily in the West is disability insurance. So we've suggested some language there that would make clear that particular issue, that health insurance would be included in the definition of disability insurance rather than the other way around. We have prepared a fiscal note with a number of caveats that have been posed to us by the sponsor. Included in those caveats are that the amount of subsidy to be available would be $200,000. We have come up with a fiscal note of $509,000 for a pilot program. Unfortunately, I was unable to have that signed today, but I will have it for you tomorrow morning as soon as that's, that has been signed by the commission. I can go further into that if you like as to how we've come up with it, but it is a bare bones authority. The authority in this bill is basically the entity that has the decision-making role. They're the ones that say how the coverages will be structured, how the thing will operate. They operate through an administrative arm, an executive director, a deputy director. And so we have established a bare bones administration, the executive director, the deputy director, and one secretary. I'm not certain that they're going to be able to do everything they need to do, but we were trying to keep this thing as tight as we could to be as reasonable and realistic as we could. If after you've had an opportunity to review that fiscal note, when I have it for you, I'd be happy to come back and talk about it some more or answer any questions you might have. Do you have any questions on this subject?
Anyone with specific questions on 73, or would Mike, would either you or Kathy like to make any comments in relation to the specifics?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. On recommendation number 3, Senator Curtula has proposed an amendment to take care of that. I don't think that we have any specific, or that Senator Curtula has any specific problems with the other recommendations in the position paper. It's my understanding, though, that it's the drafting attorney's opinion that some, at least, of them are unnecessary. So possibly you want to hear from him.
Madam Chairman, there are 2 points that Don raised that perhaps I can elaborate on. As far as the location of the authority in Title 21, I know that the division is concerned that there is an appearance of conflict here, but the powers and duties of the authority are the same no matter where they're placed in the statutes. So if it's placed in another title or in Title 21, it doesn't change the substantive provisions of the bill. So our position is that the organization of the code is basically the job of the revisor statutes, and he would prefer that it be in Title 21. So that, for what it's worth, is our position on that. As far as the definition of insurance or health insurance, I understand the term of art is disability. However, there are some connotations to that term that some people are not do not like. So we use the term health insurance as opposed to disability insurance. And in order to tie health insurance into the existing term of disability insurance, it was defined to include that. So that is the reason it was done that way. And I think the suggestion by the Division of Insurance would not suffice as far as this bill is concerned, because the question is, what is the definition of health insurance? And maybe we can come up with another approach that would satisfy their problem, but that's the reason it was drafted that way. We need to make sure that health insurance is tied into all of the other references in Title 21 that refer to disability insurance. So again, that was that issue there. Was there something else?
The reserve fund mechanism.
Oh, right. As far as the legislature's funding, the a prudent level of reserve funds for the solvency of the fund to provide health insurance, that would be a required appropriation by the legislature. As far as whether it crosses fiscal years or not, depending on the nature of the fund, it may be possible to set it up so that it would not require continuing appropriation.
Okay.
but that is an important issue.
Let's see, move on to 74.
If I may, Madam Chairman, may I rebut? As to the issue about Title 21, the sure. Director of Insurance is provided a role in this on this authority. He's a member of it, and so I contend that that conflict still exists. We don't like it in 21 anyway, but. If it's in 21 and we're isolated so that the Director of Insurance had nothing to do with it, that would be one issue. But in this case, the Director is a functioning member of that authority, and we think that's inappropriate. End of rebuttal. The rest I think we need to talk about with Mr. Ford and see if we can resolve those. Excuse me. Unless he wants rebuttal. On Senate Bill 74, we have likewise provided a position paper. This too had some concerns in it. The principal one was that we were not fully satisfied that the full faith and credit of the state would not be behind this association should the association neglect its responsibilities in furnishing the, I guess the best term would be reinsurance for this mechanism. Mr. Ford assures us that, indeed, the full faith and credit of the state is not exposed. We have, therefore, since attempted to come up with a pricing on the bill. We will have a fiscal note for you tomorrow that will be just slightly under $10,000. The purpose for that note is to provide for some travel and during the formation of this pooling mechanism. Also to provide for some consultation as we develop regulations or attempt to review the plan of operation that this association can come up with. The burden is primarily placed on the insurers in this particular bill. With the amendments that were suggested by Kathy Hathaway today, I think she goes a long way to meeting some of the concerns we have here. We do have a copy of the consulting actuary's work on other pools that she was referring to, and indeed they indicate that if you take out two of the mature states, the result is somewhere around 139% loss ratio for the remaining 11. If you add the two states that are causing the real problems, we don't have any idea why, those are Connecticut and Indiana, the amount goes to 165%. On top of that, they have an 8% average administration across the 13 states that have mature plans. We had indicated to Ms. Hathaway, that we were concerned with the 125% level, primarily because the same section refers to rate standards. One says that the rate shall not be excessive, and the other says the rate shall not be inadequate, and goes on to say that the rates are capped at 125%. And in view of that actuary's work and frankly, the unknowns that rest in this, we felt that there was a real conflict there and that we would have some problems with it. I admit we still have some problems with it, but if there is some flexibility in the amount of that cap, and there's a willingness for the legislature to take a look at that cap should it not be sufficient to contain it, I think that we wouldn't have any further problems with it. The position for this particular bill needs to go back to our commissioner, frankly, for his thoughts on it, and we'll be making recommendations to him. I'm sorry that this hasn't been done, but we just received really what amount to final instructions as to what kind of caveats to use on this from the sponsor. I don't want to call those instructions exactly, but kind of an indication of what their intent was. Knowing that intent, now we've had to revisit the whole subject, so we're not as prepared as we'd like to be on that, but we'll have more. Unless there's any questions on that one, I'll proceed.
Any questions, sir? Okay.
On Senate Bill 76, Our position is we feel the legislation is unnecessary. In 1981, the legislature passed legislation that allowed the Division of Insurance to adopt regulations dealing with Medicare supplements. And at that time, we proceeded with the adoption of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners model legislation on the subject. Those were in final adoption as of March 26, 1982. More recently, those were amended also per amendments made by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners on August 8, 1990. So last year, we added a number of provisions, including one that I know the sponsor was concerned with, and that deals with overinsurance. It prohibits overinsurance. It requires insurance companies to report to us when they have more than one contract issued to an insured. It places barriers to the insurers providing more than 100% coverage on these things, which should eliminate or certainly come close to eliminating the abuse that we've seen in other areas, and which I'm sure also occur here, where people go out and prey on the elderly trying to sell these contract after contract. We have a number of states that are very interested in this issue. California's been taking the lead on some of it, and we've been keeping in touch with them as to what the state of the art is in terms of detection. We believe that regulation is the best way to do this because it gives us the flexibility to get in and change it as quickly as the National Association of Insurance Commissioners changes it. And as that technology changes, or as we see the need to address a particular Alaska situation, we have the flexibility to do so. All of the things that are intended by the current legislation are currently addressed in regulation. So we think we have enough. That's the extent of my testimony. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Excuse me, we also have Jay Frank from State Farm and Allstate to sign up for Senate Bill 74.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We are on teleconference, so please make sure it's on.
It is. Thank you.
Great.
My name is Jay Frank. I'm here this afternoon on behalf of State Farm and Allstate Insurance Companies to testify about some of their concerns on Senate Bill 74. In concept, State Farm and Allstate support this type of legislation where, through the use of a pooling arrangement, you can basically provide insurance coverage for those individuals who otherwise wouldn't be qualified to receive health insurance. And the mechanics of this bill are relatively simple, and it works the same way in the NAIC model as well. What happens is you form a definition of individuals who aren't insurable, and then you go out and you form the Association of Insurers who normally write health insurance. Then this bill establishes a cap on what you can charge those people for premiums, and it provides that anything that you lose above and beyond what you receive in your premiums, the insurers pay as an assessment. So there, in the NAIC model, State Farm and Allstate could support with without any qualification. The problem is that this bill essentially expands the group that would be insured, does not allow the pool to charge a realistic premium to cover what it's going to cost to insure those people, and then basically through the use of an assessment requires those insurers to contribute money above and beyond what they've, what the premium dollars are to make up for the losses. And I'll give you an example of that. The first example in terms of the definition of the group, on page 14, line 9 and 10, subsection B basically says that someone who is a high-risk resident, all they have to do is have a restrictive rider placed upon a health insurance policy. Now, restrictive riders are very, very common in health policies, and what it allows an insurer to do is it allows the insurer to say, look, if we acknowledge that you have a particular health problem, and we're not going to cover you for that health problem, but we will provide you with insurance for all your other health needs. By allowing an individual who might have just one rider for their health insurance coverage, for example, a heart condition, diabetes condition, to be deemed to be uninsurable, you are going to open up the eligibility for this pool to a large number of individuals. So we've already got a potential that this pool will have many, many members in it. Secondly, page 8, line 17. When we talk about the premium that pool is going to be allowed to charge, and I think you've heard some testimony this afternoon that the 125 figure is going to be low. And I think that's somewhat of an understatement. The NAIC model legislation in this area says that the premium charged shall not be less than 150% of that which is normally charged, nor greater than 200%. The reason behind that is, let's face it, this is a group of high-risk individuals. They would not be high-risk individuals if an insurance company was not going to be paying out a lot of money on claims for these individuals. So it's certainly unrealistic to say that you can't charge more than 125% of the premium, and it's far more realistic to allow the pool the ability to charge, as the NAIC model does, up to 200% of what the normal premium is. That's not to say that's going to be the premium that will be charged. It just gives them the ability and the flexibility to charge the premium that's going to be realistic. And let's see what the offset of this is if you don't allow the pool to charge a realistic premium, you're going to increase the assessment that the members are going to be hit with, because the premium dollars do not cover what the losses are. And if the assessments are increased, what you have is the healthy insurance buying public basically subsidizing the unhealthy insurance buying public. Now, in other words, the assessments are going to come from the insurer. The risk is going to be borne by everyone who buys health insurance. It's far more equitable to allow this pool the ability to charge a realistic premium and let the people who require the extra health insurance pay for that extra health insurance, and not those individuals who don't have the health type of problems. So we would like to see a provision in here that models what the NAIC does, that says that the rates are not lower than 150%, no higher than 200%. And as Don Koch said, that the loss experience eventually is going to bear itself out, and we'll see what these premiums ought to be. But 125, and I'll submit even 140%, is going to be too low. Let's let these people pay the coverage they're going to get, and not, through the use of the assessment, require other people to contribute. The NAIC model also allows that there be a premium tax offset for any amount of an assessment that the insurers are required to pay. This, again, spreads the risk of insurers losing money out across a greater number of people. We would like to see a tax offset in there. And finally, the NAIC model also includes a provision that prohibits members of the pool from seeking any kind of joint or collective action for some sort of criminal or civil liability. I don't know if this, I suspect this deals with some sort of antitrust type of situation, but again, it provides some protection to the people who are in the pool. I don't have any other comments. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Frank? Thank you very much for being with us today. We have at least two people on teleconference interested in testifying. The first in Homer, Velma Ellison.
My name is Velma Ellison. I'm care within the home, where the stronger spouse is given a break, if you want to call it that, to be able to continue to take care of the other spouse in the home, and yet it wouldn't make any difference if the person had seven different Medigap kinds of policies. There is not the medical insurance policy to cover the kind of care that people are needed. You're talking about Medicare insurance coverage, and yet supplemental insurance, but where is the long-term care options for Alaskan seniors? AARP put out a booklet in 1989 that was a comparison between different insurance companies showing the length of time they could stay in a hospital, the length of time they could stay in an intermediate or a skilled facility, and so forth. Nowhere is there information nor policies at this time available that would what I call coverage of the alternative care facilities and methods that will in the long run save the state, insurance companies, everybody else a lot of money if there is some kind of protection for people who simply need assistance in their daily living. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Any questions for Velma? Thank you very much, ma'am. We appreciate your being with us. We also have in Glen Allen a gentleman, and sir, I'm afraid I'm probably going to mispronounce your name, Bob Niebruck?
Bob Niebruck.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, I'd like to speak about Senate Bill 74, and I'm one of those individuals that would benefit from the passage of this particular type of legislation. I happen to be a self-employed diabetic, and as self-employed, I'm not involved or do I have access to a group insurance plan. As a diabetic, I'm one of those people who is considered to be uninsurable. And so I can assure you that it creates quite an anxiety on myself and for my family. We would be happy to pay the additional premium required and as defined in the risk pool if it were available. But in truth, as we start to look for our own health insurance plan, we find that there just aren't any out there because I have one of these diabetic conditions that excludes me from getting access to the insurance. I started to search for health insurance a number of years ago and discovered that risk pools were being formed in other states across the country, and indeed a great deal of momentum has been shifting towards this type of legislation. And it seems to me that it is, at least for people in my situation, it's as close to ideal as we can get at this time. It certainly doesn't create a burden for the taxpayer, and it shouldn't, if, as a lot of discussion has taken place today about what the appropriate premium cap should be. I would think that 125% probably is low, 140% is probably low, and as the insurance representative was saying, 150 or maybe 150 to 200% wouldn't be unreasonable. I think most people in my situation aren't so concerned about the cost as it is the access to the insurance. Obviously, we're high risk, and I expect to pay more for the health insurance. But until this kind of legislation is put into place, there's just no option that is acceptable. There's no option, period. I would take one slight exception with the fellow from State Farm and Allstate in saying that the creation of just a rider on a policy shouldn't be a reason to be included in this risk pool. To the contrary, that's the exact reason why people should be in the pool. Diabetes is a rider that can be put on. I could certainly get a health insurance coverage that excluded diabetes. So I suppose could a cancer person get a policy that excludes cancer, or a person with a heart murmur could get something that excluded heart problems. But in truth, that's where the greatest risk is, and that's why this problem exists. So excluding a person from the pool because they're only possess a rider of some sort is really a faulty thinking, I think, on the part of the insurance companies. Those are the people that need to be included in the pool. I guess that, in essence, that covers my feelings about it. I think that there certainly is a little refinement that needs to be done. There's a lot of data on the pools that exist in the lower 48 now. They really don't attract huge numbers of people. Washington State has a plan, and although you know the population there is considerably larger than Alaska, of course, and they have about 1,800 people in their plan. So it's not going to solve the problem for everyone, but it does very definitely solve the problem for these people. people that can afford the insurance and just simply can't get it. And so I certainly encourage the committee to pass this legislation on. I know that probably it lacks an enthusiastic lobby of supporters because the number of people in positions like myself are not organized and don't even represent a large number of people. But I can assure you that the legislation is very important to us and that it's not a piece of legislation that should be a big burden financially on the state. It's simply a matter of creating a pool that gives us the opportunity to get insurance. If there's any questions I can answer or if I can expand on my point of view, I'd be glad to.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Collins has a question for you, sir.
Thank you. If it's not an invasion of your privacy, what is the average cost that you must pay, particularly with regard to your diabetic condition, in that you're out of pocket?
There isn't any insurance available, so there's no answer to that question. Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying is your average annual cost, obviously, if you don't have insurance, you're having to pay all of your medical costs out of pocket.
I understand. I'm sorry. Yeah, in my case, I just happen to be fortunate enough to be a very healthy diabetic, so I don't have and have not had any complications at all. In fact, aside from a physical, maybe a couple $100 for a physical, and my medication is probably not more than insulin is maybe a couple $100 a year. That's the only medical expenses that I incur. But I know I'm an exception. I'm a well-controlled and I'm in good health, and so I haven't been plagued by the medical complications, but I doubt if I spend $500 a year on health insurance claims, or would if I have the insurance.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, sir, very much. David Walsh has indicated that he'd like to testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to address one point that was brought up by one of the previous people who testified, and that is the subject of the premium tax offset. The division is very much opposed to premium tax offsets, and if this or any other bill had one, we would find it virtually impossible to support the bill for the following reasons. Obviously, a premium tax offset reduces the revenue coming into the state, and that is a major policy question that I don't think should be taken on lightly. The extent to which it would be a revenue drain on the state is incalculable. It depends upon the size of the pool, the amount of the losses, et cetera, and what premium is charged. But secondly, and even more importantly, insurance is, by very definition, a cost-plus operation. The loss ratios have to be 80%, and to that, 20% for administration, profit, et cetera, is allowed. And that's fine. But in the system, there are small enough, there are too small a number of incentives to control costs. If suddenly any business can pass on any cost to the government and get a direct write-off, there is even less interest in controlling costs. In fact, there's almost a disincentive. If insurance companies, or for that matter, if anyone gets a direct dollar-for-dollar write-off for some activity, you can bet that activity will increase. Why do people buy homes? Because interest is deductible. Why do people not pay off mortgages or buy second homes? Because interest is deductible. If this or any other bill allows for a premium tax offset, you will see costs rise. There's absolutely a direct correlation, and that's no criticism of those in the insurance industry. I think it's human nature. So for those reasons, Madam Chair and members of the committee, Don Koch has done an excellent job of stating our position on the bill, but we would urge you not to adopt any premium tax offset.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Now, it was my understanding from the previous testimony that Mr. Frank was talking about a model bill, which I assume has been used in some of the states. Do you know if they've had that experience? Or?
Unfortunately, I am a very big supporter of the NAIC. It, however, like all organizations, is not a perfect organization. Their interest in premium tax offsets seems to me to be very much displaced and bordering on the tragic. We in Alaska, I think, are fortunate in that we do not have premium tax offsets. For example, in the automobile pool, there is no premium tax offset. For the Life and Health Guarantee Association, there is also no premium tax offset. And I believe that's because the legislature and the administration very wisely decided that in order to control costs, in order to also spread the risk among those who are similarly affected, there should not be a blank check with the state of Alaska's signature at the bottom. and that's basically what premium tax offsets do. I believe that over the next 5 to 10 years, there will be a move away from premium tax offsets. In my opinion, one of the reasons why the Congress has shown such a serious interest in federal regulation of insurance is exactly because of this kind of thing. I don't think it makes any sense from a public policy point of view to hand anyone a blank check for public money. And in my view, that's what premium tax offsets do.
Any questions for Mr. Walsh? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Kathy, did you want to respond to the division's assertion that 76 is not necessary, or do you want to respond to any of the other assertions anybody's made for that matter?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman.
Madam
Chair. Senator Curtula's position is that it would be much more desirable to have it in statute than regulation. He understands her position. He disagrees with it. As far as the premium tax offset, that was something that that Senator Curtula had us look at. As somebody mentioned, some other states do it, some don't. In fact, some states fund the whole the cost of the pool, the excess cost from the general fund, but that's a real small minority. As far this of the states that do that have had a premium tax offset, two states within the past 3 years have gotten rid of it. It's just on an intuitive level, we've tried to find out what costs would be associated with it, and haven't had much luck in trying to nail that down. On an intuitive level, I think that Mr. Walsh makes some good points. And also, the cost is, if you can't nail down the cost, I guess, if I wanted to characterize Senator Petula's position, it's very, very cautious as far as something like that goes. That's why he didn't include it. I think he would be much more inclined to raise the cap, raise the range than anything as far as a tax offset. Thank you.
Any other questions for Kathy? Okay, thank you very much. Does anyone else in the audience wish to testify today on either Senate Bills 73, 74, or 76? Is there anyone else on teleconference who's interested in testifying on these three bills today?
This is Bob Newbrady again and Glenn Allen.
Yes, sir?
I would just say with regard to the tax offset that those issues don't seem to me to be as important. I don't think that the state should be supporting, or should the insurance industry be supporting the costs associated with this kind of an insurance opportunity. Myself as a potential user would gladly pay the additional premium that's fit for the coverage, and if it turned out to be 150 or 175%, that's fine, that's what it would be. I think the more important issue is that the opportunity to get the insurance be created, and the cost should certainly be borne by those people that are getting the insurance. It's not my intent at all to see the state or anyone else subsidize the program, but I certainly encourage the program to become into existence.
Okay. Anyone else on teleconference who'd like to testify today?
We have someone in Homer.
Oh, okay. We have him, please.
Thompson. I live in Homer, Alaska. I'm at the Homer Senior Center. In looking at this Senate Bill number 76 proposed by Senator Curtula, I see no indication given as to the financial stability of the insurer for Medicare supplemental insurance. The second one is, on the testimony of the Allstate insurance man, on the 150 to 200% proposal he had, and the attendant costs, says a negative sign for high-risk elderly. No mention is made of the bottom line of the insurance company, whose profits have been very questionable. That's it.
I thought I was going to get caught. Sir, could we have your name again, please?
My name is Homer S. Thompson.
Thank you very much, sir. Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Thompson? Does anyone else on teleconference care to testify on any of these three bills? Okay, with that, we'll close out the public testimony. Thank you. It would be my intent to work on further with the Division of Insurance and the prime sponsor and Kathy on these three. We will be bringing them back up at a later date, probably the earliest would be the end of next week, or mid to the end of next week. Okay, I'd like to bring Senate Bill 83 up again. We've had it before us previously. You have in your packet a proposed CS Labor and Commerce that I believe has all the amendments that Senator Duncan spoke to last week. He doesn't look like it does. Okay, Senator Duncan, why don't you tell us what we have?
Sure, if I might explain what we have, and we work very closely with your staff. Felt this may be the best way to approach it because redrafting was causing some difficulty with replacement. What the CS has is the change from Title 21 to Title 44. That's the only thing it incorporates. And then, in addition to that, there are four amendments that we wanted to put into the CS, but because of recommendation from the drafter, he thought it was cleaner to do it this way in order that folks could follow through how it was being done. So that's basically CS does nothing but move from Title 21 to Title 44. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Okay, great. And that was at the request of the division to take care of some of their concerns. Since that is the change in the CS, I would like to go ahead and adopt it today so we'll have it officially before us. We do have some people who are interested in testifying today. Do you have any copies? CS draft G by Mr. Ford, dated 2/28/91. So motion to adopt the CS. Is there any opposition? Okay, the CS has been adopted and is before us. Senator Duncan, why don't you briefly speak again to your amendments, if you would please, just to give us back up to date on what you have before us, and then we'll take public testimony.
Is public testimony going to be on the amendments? Is that or on the?
No, I think. From the looks of it, public testimony is probably on the bill as a whole.
Okay. All right. I will be happy to go through the amendments. Maybe I could just do one thing, Madam Chair, before I begin. I don't know if you have in your packets, but if you don't, I would invite you to read the Anchorage Times of last Friday, I believe it was, the business section that talks about the new insurance plan that puts a lid on physician charges, which relates to something Blue Cross is doing, which goes along the lines with what this bill is doing. In fact, it's the same thing, except we're doing it on a much broader scale. And the comments in that article are very interesting about how this will be a way of controlling skyrocketing medical costs in the state, et cetera. It's just very interesting article, which ties in directly with what Senate Bill 83 is proposing, which indicates it can be done, but you need to do it on a broad scale. Getting to the amendments, if we could look at Amendment 1. And I think these are numbered up in the right-hand corner. It would be G1. It would be Amendment number 1. I hope this is not confusing. I assume, Rod, that they're all... They're in that order. The first one would be page 6 after line 11, where if after trying to procure insurance, once we're getting into cooling and once it's decided that there is no one out there that will offer insurance, RFPs have been taken, etc., if the authority elects to act as a self-insurer, the authority shall submit a plan of intended insurance coverage and benefits to the legislature, and the authority may not begin acting as a self-insurer until 60 days after the authority submits the intended plan of insurance to the legislature. The purpose behind that, and this was a recommendation again, or concern of the Division of Insurance, was that there be a final review before we get ourselves into the position of being an insurance company or offering insurance. And this would only happen if, the way this is structured, if the private market did not provide a plan that this authority might put together. And that's the purpose of that amendment, is to provide legislative review.
Senator Havick?
Question, does this require that they make this notification during session? What happens if they make the decision the 15th of May?
Well, what this was intended was that the legislature would be sitting in session and have 60 days to review, not that they would do it in June and we're out of session and the 60-day period elapses. If the wording is not clear, the intent was it would go through a period of 60-day review by the legislature, where we'd be in session to actually take action if we wanted to tell them, no, don't do it, or whatever. That was the intent.
Yeah, I don't think it does that the way it's drafted.
So you would intend that the authority have a window of opportunity each year that would coincide with our session
to make
a decision, but then that would have to be submitted to us.
And I don't, maybe the wording isn't clear that way. That's what the intent was. In fact, I'm not quite sure if we're not in session if we've got a legislature to submit it to. So I guess they do, but I don't know where it would go. But that was the intent, sir. It's not clear whether it needed to be corrected then. Page two, then. The big amendment, it's a two-page amendment, but it's really not that big if you look at it. Two-page amendment, the addition is on page two of the two-page amendment. We go on page two after line 31, where it's talking about the duties of the Legislative Budget Audit Committee. And one of the duties of the Legislative Budget Audit Committee would be to provide for an annual post-audit and annual operational and performance evaluation of the Alaska State Health Resources Authority. That's the last language on page two of this amendment. It's just to give further oversight, and oversight that wouldn't be done by the Division of Insurance, for example, but to give oversight by another entity. And in our discussions, again, I think with the Division of Insurance, this is a recommendation we came up with. So it's a long amendment, but it just adds one clause. And that's to give further review. Shall I go ahead with the next?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The next Please. Amendment is page 3, line 29. We want to make it specific that what we're talking about here is a phased implementation, that it's not going to happen all at once. And so we insert the words, a phased implementation of a statewide geographic specific. It's also to make it clear that the reimbursement schedules, the utilization standards, weren't one statewide schedule, but statewide geographic specific, which means Anchorage could have one schedule, Fairbanks, Juneau, whatever, that they would be taking consideration, geographic considerations and difference of cost between the areas. And it was to be phased in instead of done all at once. Page 3, then, you can read that language there, but that's to make it clear that it's also to be phased, and it phases it out over a two-year period of time to be sure that it can be done correctly and the authority has the ability to work with providers over a period of time to establish these reimbursement system and utilization standards. There's some important language here. The authority shall establish a reimbursement system and utilization standards prospectively, utilizing the most accurate information available to the authority regarding defined reliable components of the reimbursement system and utilization standards. So it is intended to direct the authority to work very closely with providers to get accurate information to set those. So it's not being done in a vacuum, but it's being done reflecting what the actual provider costs are, et cetera. Then it says we do some other additions in the rest of the amendment is to ensure that there is time for public comment, which would be not only public but provider comment on any of the schedules. It says at least 60 days before implementing, they should take public comment. And then also not directing how it should be done in this bill, but directing the authority to establish a grievance procedure to resolve disputes between the authority and participants, so that there is some type of a grievance procedure set up for the in this by the authority. Also, wherever you'll notice we've deleted the word obtain in a couple of areas and put in the words procure or provide, because that's the real intent, is to either procure or provide, whichever might have to do. Some of that's corrective language, some of it's to make it clear that we're talking about phasing and to also make it clear that we're talking about the actual cost. Then the final amendment, Madam Chair, we go back to page one, and I apologize, these are in this order. I don't know why we didn't go from front to back, but that's, I guess, we thought of them, and as we asked the draft to do it, that's where they came out. Page one, then, we would make it clear in the purpose section that we're talking about phase implementation of statewide geographic specific health care provider reimbursement systems and utilization standards. And then when we talk about procurement, after July 1st, 1992, begin the procurement or provision of a comprehensive group health insurance plan for individuals, groups, or individuals, et cetera. That's just further defined, a better definition of what we had before. Number three on that amendment is new. and I think it's important language. Assure financial protection for participants and beneficiaries, provide equitable payments to healthcare providers, and slow the increase in healthcare expenditure. We will make it clear in the purpose section, it's not the purpose of this authority to go in and discount on the dollar to the providers, but to provide financial protection for the participants, for the beneficiaries, and provide equitable payment to healthcare providers. That's got to be, in my mind, the bottom line. And I think all of us realize that. You need quality healthcare providers in the state. And the idea is not to discount them, but to help slow that inflationary rate after we've identified the components of healthcare increases, healthcare cost increases. And that's basically the heart of that amendment. So there's those four, some of them kind of lengthy, but more wordy than what may be necessary, and that's what we drafted them.
I have a question, Senator Duncan. On your phasing in of the system, you talk about at least 50% in your amendment. Is that 50%, 50% of what? 50%?
Yeah, I read that too, and it's not very clear. The idea was to be not 50% of every provider or every hospital or doctor, but 50% of the volume, for example. If you look at the dollar volume of what was being spent, the 50%. And maybe that's not the best way to talk about phasing. I mean, I've been struggling with trying to figure out how to put the phasing language in. Haven't got too much help from the providers yet, but I'm sure they're going to start helping me on this language. And there may be better language, right? The intent is to assure them that we're not going to come in arbitrarily on July 1st, 1992, put in a schedule that's supposed to cover everybody in the state, but that we're willing to work over a period of time to phase these in working with them. And that was an attempt to give that type of assurance. And what we were looking at was not by numbers of providers, but by volume of business.
Do you know?
I'm not saying that's a perfect definition, by the way.
Having spoken, I assume, with the Blue Cross people, do you have any idea of what percentage of the providers that they approached, signed up, or signed onto their program? Any feel for that at all?
No, I don't have any idea. And of course, as you read this article, you'll find providers who signed up. I mean, they signed up. Some of them say that they were coerced. I don't know if they were or not. So we don't know how many. The important part, why I wanted to provide this article, the important points made in this article, I think, Madam Chair, are that several statements are made here that I think is what we're trying to get at. For example, the fellow from Blue Cross says the new physician network is not expected to reduce costs dramatically, but will slow down inflation and medical costs over a period of time. The fellow who's head of the Anchorage School District program won't exactly stem the 12 to 15% a year, but will hold down significantly in the future. Win-win situation. You know, the idea isn't to discount the cost, it's to slow down the inflationary rise. The only problem with this type of approach, by the way, if I could just expand, you asked me. I'm doing more than answering questions. The difficulty with this type of approach is Blue Cross may do this with 94 physicians, or Blue Cross may do it with their plans, but there's the opportunity here because it's not global, because it's just Blue Cross, that these providers will shift the cost over to some other plan. I'm not saying they would, but they could shift cost under this scenario because there's other plans who don't have these same schedules. And what we're trying to propose in this legislation is we do it globally, that we get providers in all payer systems so there's not cost shifting. And we control the cost, the inflationary spiral, basically the same way Blue Cross is doing with their plan, but we do it globally so there can't be cost shifting from one payer to another payer, and that's the only danger of this. But the article, I think, is indicative that it can work, and as I read this, I don't see anybody saying that it won't control the inflationary spiral. They all say it will. But I don't know how many didn't sign up, and et cetera.
Other questions for the Senator? Okay, let's go ahead and take the testimony from people. Well, actually, let me go first to Haynes. I understand that Dr. Stanley Jones is online. He specifically wanted to testify to Senate Bill 74, but would like to speak perhaps more globally to all of these. Dr. Jones, are you there?
Yes.
If you'd like to go ahead, sir.
I'm Dr. Stanley Jones of Haines, Alaska, and I would like to read a letter that I wrote to President Reagan and Secretary Boland and Senator Stevens and Senator Kowalski and Young, Representative Young, Governor Cooper. to the senators and representatives of the state of Alaska in 1988, but I think it's still very appropriate, and so I will read that. I'm writing to try to explain some of the things that are forcing me out of the rural practice of medicine. The government claims that it wants to encourage rural medicine, but the facts seem to support a different conclusion. To illustrate my concerns, I have enclosed the tabulated results of my profit and loss statements over the past 10 years. Ames is a rural community with no hospital and only one medical office and two physicians for most of the years of this report. The closest hospital is 70 miles away by air or water, and there are many times when darkness or weather prevents immediate transportation and medical emergencies. Therefore, we provide all the patient care that is available. I also provide medical care for Skagway where there are no physicians. I hire two physician assistants to operate the office in Skagway. I go to Skagway for a clinic every week or two at a cost of $70 to $100 or more for the round-trip airfare. That explains why my travel expenses are so high. At times, there has only been one physician here. We have a physician on call 24 hours a day, 365 days of the year. We therefore work many hours and spend a lot of time on call. To add perspective, our cost of living is high, and the federal government employees at the Post Office, U.S. Army Petroleum Division, have minimum wages of from $23,000 per year for a person with a high school education to $54,000 per year for a person who operates equipment or does welding or electrical work. This does not include their additional pay for shift differential and overtime. School teachers earn $27,500 to $48,000 per year. The government also provides its workers with health insurance, sick leave, and retirement benefits. Fund comparable benefits for my income. However, their tools, equipment, and supplies are furnished, whereas I have to provide my own. An inventory of $50,000 of drugs and supplies and at least $80,000 of equipment in the office. Because there is no hospital in the area, I hire the nurses and staff for treating emergencies and after-hours care. I am therefore guaranteeing the wages for my staff, whether Medicare, Medicaid, or the patient pays me or not. With my nearly $500,000 of yearly receipts and a net pre-deduction income of only about $47,000 to $51,000 for the last 2 years, there is little incentive to continue this work. A 2.5% gram equivalent reduction on my entire receipts would amount to a $10,000 personal loss of salary to me. In contrast, the local federal government employees just received a raise. How can I encourage a young physician to come here when I retire with a financial picture like this and with indications of worse to come? What will the Haineses of America do then for medical care? My fees have been frozen by Medicare, and with Medicaid beneficiaries, we have to accept the Medicare schedule as payment in full. We are paid nothing for services that someone in the Medicare Carrier's Office or ACFA, who does not understand the realities of medical practice here, deems unnecessary. Medicaid pays so little for insurance costs for delivery that I had to discontinue them. My medical practice insurance costs for the practice went from $10,000 in 1984 to $69,500 in 1987. I have now stopped doing deliveries because I could no longer collect enough from all deliveries to pay for my premium. Now my patients have to leave Ames and Skagway 2 to 3 weeks before their expected delivery. I have never had a malpractice case filed against me for any reason, so my insurance charge is not high because of a poor record. My malpractice insurance carrier is a corporation established by the state of Alaska with the state insurance commissioner on the board. Despite it not increased charges in 1987, my malpractice premium increased from 84 to 87 would have eliminated a large percentage of my income. Medicare tells me I'm over my MAC, that's my maximum allowable active charges, and I'm therefore subject to mandated refunds and heavy fines and possible imprisonment. However, I do not have the fund surplus in my practice to make refunds and do not plan to. In addition to malpractice insurance, the other reason for my financial plight is the administrative workload brought on by Medicare, Medicaid, and insurance companies. We used to put down a written procedure and diagnosis, for example, office call and tonsillitis. Now we need to put down 90050 and 463, or whatever is appropriate. This sounds well and good, but we use some of the codes infrequently and have trouble finding a code that is fair to the patients and accurate. Two sizable books constitute the list of codes. When I take care of a stroke or heart attack patient and bill for 4 hours of physician care at $150 per hour, I use code 99151 and have been allowed a charge of $150.70 for the 4 hours of care. I cannot operate my office for that allowance. Then there are additional forms and letters to write and fill out to try to get more reimbursement. Therefore, my administrative expenses and the cost of medical care goes up, and the cost of the intermediary, Aetna and Medicare, goes up too. Insurance companies are Medicare advised that I had to bill Medicare and accept the Medicare fee schedule as payment in full with no billing to the patient. Unable to buy the material to do the test for the Medicare allowance with no pay to offset wages, equipment, amortization, etc. I have quit doing the test completely as I cannot afford to operate the equipment. Now Medicare allows nothing for collection and preparation of laboratory specimens. We collect and mail specimens to laboratories because there is no laboratory at hand to whom I can refer patients. This takes a lot of time and effort. I fail to understand why someone can tell me that I must provide the services and the time of myself and my employees that I must pay without any possibility of recovering financially. I feel it is important for the people of the United States Congress to know what is happening. Thank you for taking your available time to read this letter. If I can help with other information or answer your questions, please write to me and I will try to find the time to answer. If one of your staff could spend some time in my office and see what it takes to arrange for the care of patients, I feel that they would be impressed with what has become a significant factor in increasing the cost of medical care. I have loved the practice of medicine and have done many things without pay, but please help create a more efficient system. Act quickly, though, or I may leave and be a true missionary in Africa or wherever I choose, and not a, quote, congressionally mandated bankrupt missionary, end quote. Sincerely, Stanley and Jones, M.D. That was the letter that I sent in 1988. A few things have changed since then, and along with that, I sent a summary of my profit and loss statements over the prior 11 years, and my income peaked in 1983 at $73,637. In 1986, my income was $50,938. In 1987, $48,256. Out of that, I paid approximately $5,000 Social Security. I paid my own retirement program, and I also paid for my own health insurance. And so, consequently, I was working for about the same take-home pay as a first-year school teacher at Haynes, and with considerable investment. And so, I think that this bill represents another similar episode that will create more paperwork and less time to take care of patients and more office overhead. And so on December 31st, 1989, I quit the practice of medicine in Haynes. And last year, I covered for the physician here for 2 weeks. I said, to heck with it. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Jones. Any questions? Thank you, sir, for joining us. Here in Juneau, Jay Frank has asked to testify on 83.
June made a lot of big bucks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jay Frank. I'm here on behalf of State Farm and Allstate this afternoon with a very limited opposition to the CS for Senate Bill 83. This bill deals with controlling health care costs, and the only problem that we have with it is the definition set out on page 7, starting at line 22, defines group health insurance to include coverage that may include life insurance, accidental death, and dismemberment, and then it continues on with medical care, treatment, dental care, eye care. The difficulty we have with this is that this is a health bill. We don't see any reason why life insurance ought to be included in the definition of what group health insurance is, and the same thing with the ADD, the accidental death and dismemberment. They're just different types of coverages. To the best of my knowledge, there's no problem in the state of anyone going out and buying life insurance. I think that because of the way it's written, it's not subject to the same types of concerns that you have with the rising health care costs, and the same with the ADD coverage. We just don't see any need for this to be in there in the definition section. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Duncan.
So Jay, if we took that out, you would actually be saying you're testifying in support of this bill?
I'm not saying I'm going to support it, but I'm not saying I'm going to oppose it.
I was looking for somebody I could easily pick up here.
Now, you can slip one by me every once in a while, but not that easily. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Hey, does anyone else want to testify today on Senate Bill 83 or any of the amendments? Okay, thank you. What I'd like to do, Senator Duncan, if it's all right with you, is work with your staff on a couple of those amendments where we have some wording questions, and we will bring the insurance bills back up, as I said earlier, probably the end of next week, mid to end of next week. I don't remember what the schedule is, but we'll look at it. And I, Well, I thought that we were not going to have a meeting this Wednesday. We're still not going to have a meeting, but we may end up doing a work session because I'm not going to be in town tomorrow, so I'm going to be here, so we'll let you know.
Good.
Okay.
Always available.
Anything else to come before the committee? If not, we adjourn.
Thank you.